but he defers. And I think he defers because, as Curtis pointed out, that he knew God was going to keep his promise regardless of what direction Lot chose. So I thought that was an example of faith. And then this is something that, if you remember the text, let's see. So Lot traveled east and they separated. And then the next paragraph, verse 14, Yahweh said to Abram after Lot was separated from him, "Now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward, for I will give all the land which you see to you and to your offspring forever." So Lot chooses one direction, and Abram defers to Lot. And then after Lot is gone, God steps back and says, "Hey, Abram, you're getting it all. In every direction." And that, I think, speaks to Abram's faith to allow Lot to do whatever he wanted to do, but God says he's going to get it all. Now, the other thing I noted, where he talks in verse 17, "Arise, walk through the land and its length and its width, for I will give it to you." And Abram moved his tent and came and lived by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and built an altar there to Yahweh. So the fact that God says, "You're going to get all this," and he tells them to do something. He says, "Get up, walk through this land," and Abram does so. Okay, so it's just a demonstration of faith throughout. It might be a subtle thing, but I think it connects what he believes and then what he does. He does what God tells him to do. Okay, any other thoughts, Ben? Now, I mentioned this last time, and I'll just keep mentioning it again. This is my suggestion that these are short texts, so if you could read the text and then reread it, and it'd be helpful to you to make a note of anything you see as far as key people, key characters, key places, key events, key phrases, anything that strikes you in that way, key connections to other scripture, and any other noteworthy items. Okay, so if you just kind of have that mindset as you go through the text, I think that would be helpful. And I'll stop here to say my questions, there's nothing special about them. They're just kind of a guideline to get us into class discussion. So if you see something that's noteworthy and you want to bring it out, I encourage that. Okay. And then reread the text and answer the questions as best you can. And lastly, is if you want to, if there's something you want to look at a commentary, do it last. Do all this first. I think it'll be beneficial to you. And then look at a commentary and see what they have to say, if you want to, at that point. So that's my suggestion. Hopefully you'll benefit from it as much as I have. So really, you're reading the text three times by doing it this way. And that's most important. Okay, so let's read it together, chapter 14. A lot of names, so I thought about asking Ben to read it, but... All right, we'll do the best we can here. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, sorry, I butchered that one, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goam, they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeber, king of Zeboam, and the king of Bela, also called Zoar. All these joined together in the valley of Siddim, also called the Salt Sea. They served Chedel, I'm going to call him C, we'll just call Chedi. They served Chedi for 12 years, and in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year of Chedi, and the kings who were with him came and struck the Rephaim in Ashtoreth, Carnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shava Karathaim, and the Horites in the mount in their Mount Seir, to El Paran, which is by the wilderness. They returned and came to En-Meshpat, also called Kadesh, and struck all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites that lived in Hazazon Tamar. The king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboam, and the king of Bela, also called Zoar, went out, and they set the battle in array against them in the valley of Siddim, against Chedi, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goam, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and some fell there. Those who remained fled to the hills. They took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, and all their food, and went their way. They took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who lived in Sodom, with his goods, and departed. One who had escaped and came and told Abram, the Hebrew, at that time he lived by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, and brother of Aner. They were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his relative was taken captive, he led out his 318 trained men, born in his house, and pursued as far as Dan. He divided himself against them by night, he and his servants, and struck them, and pursued them to Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. He brought back all the goods, and also brought back his relative Lot and his goods, and the women also, and the other people. The king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedi and the kings who were with him in the valley of Shava, that is, the king's valley. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. He blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. Blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." Abram gave him a tenth of all. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and take the goods for yourself." Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have lifted up my hand to Yahweh, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread, nor a sandal strap, nor anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.' I will accept nothing from you except that which the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their portion." Okay. I don't know about you, that's a difficult text to read and understand what necessarily is going on, at least portions of it, with all those names and places, but we'll do the best we can. So, if you went through this exercise, at least for me, it was helpful to try and actually list it this way. So, hopefully you were successful in doing so. The four kings against the five. So, now, I wasn't sure this would work. Kim, can you see that okay? Yeah, okay. So you got the four kings on the left-hand side as you read the text. And then in parentheses, you've got the where they're from or whatever. And then the five kings and then where they're from. Okay, so there's some observations here that I think big picture we ought to make. Okay, what's the first question is, which kings rebelled against the others? 5 rebelled against the 4, and it appears that Chedi is kind of the leader of this group of kings, but they all allied together. Okay. And how long were the 5 kings subject to the 4 kings? 12 years. What does subject probably mean? What was going on? Tribute, most likely. So they were having to give them money. So the 5 kings were giving this money to the 4 kings, and they finally got tired of always sending the money, so they decided to rebel.
Okay.
So I know I didn't ask these questions, so work with me. What of these names or places become more significant as we continue our study of Genesis? What jumps out to you? Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay. Zoar, very good. What about those other two? Adma and Zeboam? That's not one that just jumps up to your mind, right? But they had the same fate as Sodom and Gomorrah. They were cities that were destroyed. We just know of Sodom and Gomorrah or think of them, but they were other in that area that were destroyed. Deuteronomy 29:23 says, "The whole land burned out with brimstone and salt, nothing sown and nothing growing where no plant can sprout, an overthrow like that of Sodom and Gomorrah, Adma and Zeboam, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and wrath." That's Deuteronomy 29:23. And as Emily pointed out, Genesis 19 is the account where we'll get into that Lot begs to flee from Sodom. He wants to go to Zoar. Okay. All right. Very good. So that's that side. How about the other side? Is there anything, any names or anything that jump out to you? Yes, Mason.
Isn't Shinar mentioned in the Tower of Babel?
Yes. So that's the land of Shinar. Yes, where do I have that? Yeah, Genesis 11. "Now the whole earth had one language and the same words, and as the people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there." Okay, so that is correct. So that area, this guy is king. Okay. Somebody look up Acts 2 verse 9. Can someone do that for me? Acts 2 verse 9. Go ahead, Kurt. Read that for us. Okay, so I bring that up because it's Elam, Elamites. So apparently even by the time of Acts, those are the people that descended from that area. Okay. Let's see. So it wasn't the kings where I had this listed. Sorry. Was the Rephaim mentioned here in the text? Somewhere? I must... Thank you. I didn't... There you go. So, Chedi and the kings who were with him came and struck the Rephaim in Ashtaroth, Carnaim. So, Rephaim, does that ring a bell with anybody? That's not what I'm thinking, but it's possible. The only thing I saw, I remembered that sounded familiar, so I looked at it. So you guys aren't on, you're fine, you know, if you don't remember. But this was interesting to me. So in Deuteronomy 3, verse 11, it says, "For only Og, the king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim." Okay. "Behold, his bed was a bed of iron, Is it not Rabbah of the Ammonites? 9 cubits was its length and 4 cubits its breadth, according to the common cubit. So the point is, this guy was huge because he was a descendant of Rephaim, so apparently they're big people. For what that's worth. All right. So I'm not asking you to look for obscure things. There's some things that I think are helpful to understand, and some things that will come up more so down the road. Okay. Question number 2. So who were the allies of Abram and who else helped him? Mason? Okay. Those are his allies. What was their relationship to each other? They're all brothers, okay? All right. Who else assisted him besides his allies? Okay. That's correct. That's what I'm looking for. So we see this name, Oaks of Mamre. Okay, well, this is the guy. And then he's got trees in his property, apparently. And you see this referenced all the time. So, you know, how people end up becoming places down the road. So you'll see this. But you'll see that phrase as we study through this, the Oaks of Mamre. Now, in the cave of Machpelah. Yes, that's correct. So, and we mentioned this last time that the Oaks of Mamre, that location that was obviously named after this guy, later was known as Hebron. Okay, there's lots of stuff that happens in Hebron. The Lord appears to Abram by the Oaks of Mamre in Genesis 18. And that's the text where it talks about promising the angels come and promise a son within about a year time play. That's where that happened. Yes.
Mamre the Amorite, is that a relation to verse 7 where they returned and struck all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites? So would that be, I made the assumption reading through that they would be relation. So it would be maybe distant family, but not.
I did not catch that, so thank you. I don't know the answer. That's a good question. Anybody have an idea? The verse 7, it talks about the Amorites in the middle of that verse. So Mamre's an Amorite, and he's just wondering, let's see.
Kind of my question is, Mamre would have skin in it. They attacked my family.
Okay. Okay, that's good. Good observation. Very good. Any other thoughts on the allies, at least? Go ahead, Mace.
Before your question, I never considered that there maybe were more than 10 or 18 involved here, plus Abraham, plus these three, that potentially Abraham got his 10 or 18. Mm. So it seems reasonable to think that these guys got some of their own. I'm not sure if that's fair.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's conclusive. It's very possible that they have, they're probably wealthy people as well, that they're allies of Abram, but it's not mentioned because the text is focusing on Abram, of course. So what about these 318 trained servants of Abram's household? Okay, so let's note a couple things that's easy to overlook. So it's 318, that's pretty exact. What kind of servants? Trained for what? I think so. I think you're talking about only the servants who are equipped or trained for warfare. So what does that imply? What's that? Okay, that's interesting. Yes, yes. I think he has a force because that's you don't have anything else. You don't got the police to call. You don't got another army. It's your own protection. I don't know who was first. Sorry, Kurt. Go ahead.
It seems like the Wild West out there. Everybody's a king. Everybody's got their territory.
That was funny. Anthony, do you have more to add?
Hey, I was just going to say, I mean, if these are his trained servants, imagine how many untrained servants he had.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Very good.
Just trying to understand, it gives us some anchor point of how wealthy Abram is at this point, which I guess just really makes him stand out as being a real man of significance. He's not just, we think about him sometimes as just being a sojourner.
Right.
And he's just kind of like this meek, I'm only taking up a small amount of space, but like he's got a pretty significant camp with him.
Right. Yeah. And that was the point I was trying to make, so appreciate that. So it's a subtle thing that it's easy to miss, but if they describe these ones as for warfare, and these are his servants of warfare, well, that doesn't include women, doesn't include children, doesn't include those that don't have that training. So how many servants did he have? I don't know, but a lot. And Jody walked away, and of course I was going to tease her about some of us grew up in towns that are smaller than Abram's household, right? So it's a big deal. Anthony's point, that just shows you the extent of his wealth and influence and so forth, that he has his own army at this time to be able to do something like this. Okay. All right, other comments about that? Ben, go ahead.
So I think when you have these servants were born in his household.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have God on your side and you have time, like imagine having 75 years and still having another 75 years to last more and more. Like
right.
Livestock continue to reproduce and
sure.
grow. And,
right.
And so do humans. And
right.
So here he is continuing to grow his household over time.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Very good.
And so remember, he's enriched by Pharaoh.
Yes.
When Pharaoh sent him away.
Yep.
Gave him all kinds of stuff for.
So. Correct.
So yes, the time factor as well, but he was given a really good start from Pharaoh.
Right. Which I thought of this. You remember us talking about the parallels about the coming out of Egypt and Abram leaving Egypt, and the one thing I didn't mention that I just thought of is, when the children of Israel left Egypt, how did they leave? Or what were they giving? They were asked to leave, and they were given a lot. What happens in Abram's situation? He's asked to leave, and he's given a lot. So, anyway, I don't think that's coincidence. But okay, good comment. Anything else?
Scott, the only thing I was thinking of
Is, yes, that's a good point. Right.
It's not like us going camping.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Grab your pup tent. Let's go. I'll walk over here. No, it's a bigger deal, so appreciate you pointing that out. All right. Oh, forgot about this. Okay. So they came to the Valley of Eshcol. So you remember the three allies, right? One was Eshcol, so that's why I'm pointing this out. They came to the Valley of Eshcol and cut down from their branch with one cluster of grapes, and they bore it on the staff between two. They also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the children of Israel cut down from there. So the point is, the same ally of Abram is a place where, what's going on here? It's the, much later, the spies go out and they look at this valley that's named after this guy and got all this blessing. So we're familiar with the story, we just forget sometimes, okay, there's the connection between this ally of Abram and what this area ended up being called. Okay. All right. Question number three. What motivated Abram to take action? And what specifically, what did he do? Clayton. Okay. that's correct. So let's see here. So his motivation was by an attack on his family. It was not an alliance with the kings that had rebelled. Okay? I think that's important. I think that plays itself out later in the text. So he took his own people, trained men of his household. As far as Dan, if you're not familiar, Dan is very far north compared to where he would have been. So he traveled quite a bit, struck them, pursued them to Hobah, which I think was, what did I say, left of Dan or something like that. Anyway, up in that area. Brought back all the goods, Lot, women, others, people. So basically restored everything. But it is interesting that Abram's choice to save his nephew resulted in the salvation of others. And isn't that one of the promises? I mean, this is a short-term fulfillment, but isn't the promise that through you all these nations will be blessed? So, and how we, as we are blessed, we become a blessing to others. So it's that idea that he does. Because I guess he could have chosen to defeat them and take Lot and then let the others do whatever they're going to do, but he restores everybody. Okay, so the continued theme of faith and the relationship between faith and works, I think, is illustrated by Abram's actions. Was Abram concerned that he would not be successful? I mean, we don't have any indication of that in the text. I think he trusts God to do this. So 300 or so men going to fight. Do you think that the five, let's see, there's a four, yeah, he's on the four side. So the five kings, do you think they had more than 318 men? I think you have five armies. Isn't that a trilogy thing or Lord of the Rings? Anyway, these five kings, the point is that we don't know how many people he was going up against, but I think we can be pretty confident it's a whole lot more than what Abram had at his disposal. Now, someone made the point that maybe one of his allies or a couple of his allies might have had people. We don't know that. Okay, so that is a possibility. But does that remind you of anything else about 300 guys going to fight a much larger army? Gideon? Right? Then I thought about Gideon and I thought about Abram. And you think of the faith of the two. Did Gideon need some extra convincing that God was going to be on his side? Multiple times, right? And Abram doesn't seem to need that. He just does it. So maybe Abram gets it a little quicker than some others. But was Gideon successful? Did he accomplish God's will? But he needed a little bit more prodding to show. And I think that, and I want to give credit, that the commentary I just was referred to by Emily made that point. And I thought it was a worthwhile one, that some of us in our faith, we get it right away and we don't need a whole lot more prodding. I can't remember, was it Nathaniel? Where as soon, well, I'm sorry, I should remember. The one that saw Jesus at a distance and Jesus said, I know who you are. And he said, my Lord and my God. He was convinced immediately. And Jesus is like, oh, you haven't seen nothing yet. Right, my paraphrase. But yet others, like Thomas, he said he wasn't going to believe anything unless he could, you know, see him in person. Clayton, go ahead. Excellent point. Yep. Yes, so in this instance, yes, Abram was ready to go. In other instances, he does ask for some evidence. So that's an excellent point. Okay? Any other thoughts? Ben?
I think that goes to, I just have an HR issue at work, and it goes to, like, people have seasons of their life, like hard
yes.
times.
Yes. Yeah. So only thing I'll say to that is I'm not trying to elevate Abram beyond where he should be, so don't take it that way. He struggled with Sarah and going visiting places and telling half-truths just to, I mean, because that was a lack of faith in a sense, right? Because if God has promised you something, then why are you worried about that? Okay. So, thank you. Chase?
So, one thing, I know this, and I have to check myself every once in a while. I redo this, and I think, this is an overnight trip for 318 guys.
Yeah.
This is not an overnight trip.
No.
Because the rebellion was over a year long, because it's 12, they rebel in 13, and then, how do you say his name, Chetty.
Yeah, Chetty.
Goes out on the 14th year.
Right.
So, I mean, this is a long...
Correct. Excellent point. Appreciate that very much. Other thoughts? Anthony.
I was going to say that Abram's gone through a journey of different things with the Lord, whereas Gideon was kind of just starting off with being a servant of the Lord.
Right.
When we saw him in that battle. So you see the things that he learns, having traveled to the promised land, having been in Egypt and being delivered from there, you know, the promises made again to him.
Just a second, Mike. So my major point in bringing up Gideon and Abram was to contrast them. No, not contrast. Compare how they both ended faithfully. So whether we're more like Abram in the sense of we get it quicker or it takes us a little longer, point is God blessed them both for being faithful. Mike, did you have a comment? Appreciate that. Okay. Any other thoughts? Let's see. So, sorry, I should consult my notes every once in a while. So talking about Abram's faith and how he demonstrated his faith, he didn't just pray to God for those people in this bad situation. Right? He recognized that God would use him to accomplish God's purpose, which was to rescue Lot. And Abram was in a very unique position to do that. So the application for us is we are often in unique positions to use our status, our relationships, our influence to help accomplish God's will. And it may be the kind of situation where you're in that unique position and no one else really is. And God expects us to do what we can. Praying for a situation is good, but an awareness of the opportunities of what we can do is equally important, if not more important. Allow God to use us in those unique situations to make a difference. Okay, other thoughts? It might be a coworker, it might be a friend, it might be, you know, all sorts of things where you are in that unique position. You have a relationship that no one else has, and you need to act upon it. Okay, enough about that. Question number 4. Melchizedek, describe him, and what was this interaction? We don't have a lot in the text, but let's try and summarize that. Okay, King of Salem, priest. What did he do to or for Abram? Kurt?
When they got back, he brought out bread and wine. He met him, brought out bread and wine, and he blessed Abram. And then Abram gave him a tenth.
Okay. All right. So all the things you mentioned. Salem means what? Peace. Okay. Jerusalem is Salem in that, so just be aware of that. That's the idea. King of peace. So what's unique about Melchizedek that he's not only a king, right, but he's also a priest. Okay. And how'd that work out for Saul when he tried to do some priestly offerings as king? God did. So it's very unique to have king and priest. It's different than what happens in the law with the Levitical priesthood, and the kings were separate from there. But anyway, priest of God Most High, he blessed Abram, and he praised God for Abram's successful mission. And then it struck me that this God Most High, which is El Elyon, is used 4 times in the short text. So it's 3 times immediately. And then when Abram's talking to the king of Sodom, he uses that same phrase. Okay. So God Most High is who Melchizedek is a priest of, and is clearly the one that Abram is recognizing. So this isn't some pagan thing, not that we would think that, but this isn't some pagan influence or anything like that. This is, Melchizedek is the real deal. He is a priest and king of the Most High God, God Most High, and Abram is a servant of God Most High. And Abram recognizes Melchizedek and shows that he gave him a tenth of all. We learn a lot in Hebrews about this relationship and who Melchizedek is, to put this in perspective. A couple thoughts. So this is intended to be a trick question, but did Abram give a tithe? Yes or no? Tithing is part of the law that's not happened yet. He gave 10% of everything, which eventually will become tithing. That's commanded in the law. But again, on our timeline, we got to remember that the law is not in place yet. This is the patriarchal age where God speaks directly to the patriarchs and what they're supposed to do. And Abram, as kind of a foreshadowing of what's going to happen, of people of faith of Abram are going to give a tithe or a tenth of what they have. So what else does this tell us about the relationship between Abram and Melchizedek? I know Hebrews tells us explicitly, but what does this show? Kurt?
Abram looked at Melchizedek as someone higher than him status-wise,
right? So Abram viewed him as the greater. Ben.
So I think you called one of my pictures that I drew on the board a spider, right?
But yeah. But not publicly. You just did that.
But the fact that we have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as being God's people.
Absolutely. Thank you. Good point. Okay. All right. Psalm 110. Mason had a timely lesson if you were here Sunday. He talked about Psalm 110. So this is where Yahweh has sworn and will not change his mind. You're a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Hebrews 5:6-10. As he says also in another place, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. If only we could have told the Hebrew writer, hey, that's Psalm 110. But he says in another place. It's a joke. Thanks for someone laughing. He, in the days of his flesh, having offered up prayers and petitions with strong crying and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and having been heard of for his godly fear, though he was a son, yet learned obedience by the things which he suffered. Having been made perfect, he became to all of those who obey him the author of eternal salvation, named by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. So Melchizedek, in a sense, is a forerunner of Christ, and after the order of Melchizedek means that there's a likeness in their priesthoods. Which the priesthood that the Jews would have been familiar with is the Levitical priesthood, and Jesus didn't fit that mold, right? He wasn't from Levi. He was a priest after the order of Melchizedek. So let's keep reading together. Hebrews 6:20-7:17. Didn't have enough to put on the screen. Someone like to read that for us? Hebrews 6:20, last verse of the chapter through 7:17. Go ahead, Ben. Of course, we don't have but a minute left, so we'll pick up with this idea. Ken Chumley did a lesson, I believe it was Ken that did a lesson on Melchizedek, and a lot could be said, so I can't do it justice right now. Let's just go ahead and end there. We'll pick up there. I'll get new questions out to you, so appreciate all your participation. Thank you.